you know that a single freight train running on just 1 gallon of fuel can haul 1 ton of goods nearly 500 miles?
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. That's enough to replace literally hundreds of trucks on the highway. It's this astonishing feat of logistics that often operates, well, quite literally in the background of our daily lives.
You barely notice it's there, but it's crucial.
Exactly. But today, we're pulling back the curtain on one of the most significant and, frankly, pretty audacious developments in this foundational industry. We're talking about the 2023 merger that created Canadian Pacific Kansas City Limited, or CPKC, as we'll call it.
A huge deal in the rail world.
Absolutely. This wasn't just, you know, a corporate acquisition. It was a massive strategic gambit that fundamentally redrew the North American logistics map.
Completely changed the playing field.
So the core question we're exploring for you today is, how exactly did this merger, in a sector many might see as, well, kind of slow-moving or mature, create what its proponents are calling a generational opportunity?
That's the key phrase, isn't it? Generational opportunity.
It really is. We've dug deep into a pretty comprehensive investment research analysis document, and let me tell you, it reveals a fascinating multi-layered story of ambition, engineering, and definitely calculated risk.
Lots to unpack there.
Definitely. Our mission today is to unpack the strategic value, the core operational philosophy behind it all, and the crucial financial implications of CPKC's truly unique single-line railroad network.
That single-line aspect is key.
It's everything. A vast artery connecting Canada, the United States, and Mexico seamlessly. We're going to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge from this analysis, explore the powerful secular trends this company is, well, uniquely positioned to capitalize on. And yes, we will absolutely weigh the considerable risks involved.
Got to look at both sides.
Always. Because this isn't just about trains moving across tracks, right? It's about understanding the hidden arteries of North American trade and how they're being re-engineered right before our very eyes. So let's begin our deep dive.
Sounds good. So maybe before we dive right into CPKC specifically, it makes sense to zoom out a little.
Yes, set the stage.
Exactly. Because what they're doing, it really only makes sense if you understand the fundamental rules of the North American rail game. And rule number one is that this is a classic example of an oligopoly.
Okay, oligopoly, meaning just a few big players dominate.
Precisely. Think of it like a market structure, where a mere handful of dominant players control the vast, vast majority of the business. And this isn't just some, you know, academic term. It's a critical insight because it gives these incumbent railroads immense pricing power.
Ah, so they can charge more.
Well, they don't face the kind of cutthroat competition you see in other industries. This lets them consistently maintain pretty healthy profit margins over the long term. This structure also erects these formidable barriers to entry.
Meaning it's hard for anyone new to break in.
It's virtually impossible. Yeah, it makes it so difficult for new competitors to emerge and challenge the existing titans. It's almost like a perfect economic fortress for those already inside.
Got it. So who are these giants inside the fortress?
Right. When we talk about these dominant players, we're really referring to six publicly traded Class I railroads that essentially govern the North American freight landscape.
Right.
You've got two main players in the West, BNSF Railway, that's owned by Berkshire Hathaway and Union Pacific, or UP.
Okay, the big Western ones.
Then as you head east, you find CSX Transportation and Norfolk Southern, NS.
The Eastern counterparts.
And then there are the two Canadian-based transcontinental carriers, Canadian National, CN, and of course our focus today, CPKC.
Okay, so six in total.
That's right. And these six giants collectively don't just account for a large portion of freight. They operate roughly 67% of all freight rail mileage across North America. And get this, they generate a staggering 94% of the industry's total revenue.
94%. Wow. That's incredible concentration.
It really speaks volumes, doesn't it, about the nature of this powerful industry.
So those formidable barriers to entry, you mentioned what makes them so high. Is it just the tracks?
Well, it primarily comes down to immense, almost unimaginable capital investment. Imagine trying to replicate a rail network from scratch today.
Yeah, I can't even picture it.
It's not just difficult, it's practically impossible. The U.S. network alone spans nearly 140,000 route miles of track, bridges, tunnels, sprawling terminals.
Just the scale is mind-boggling.
It is. And the ongoing cost. Class I railroads collectively invest over $23 billion every single year.
Yeah.
Just to maintain and upgrade this vast critical infrastructure.
$23 billion a year.
Yep. That's about 18% of their revenue, which makes it 6 times more capital intensive than the average U.S. manufacturer.
Wow.
So this extraordinarily high fixed cost structure, it fundamentally shapes the competitive dynamic. It doesn't encourage, you know, destructive price wars because everyone has way too much invested.
Right. Nobody wants to bleed cash when they have billions tied up in tracks.
Exactly. Instead, it fosters a much more, let's say, rational competitive environment where carriers focus relentlessly on efficiency, optimizing their existing assets, and maximizing the return on that enormous capital base.
Okay, so we have this tight oligopoly, huge barriers to entry. But it's not a total free-for-all, right? There must be some oversight. Where does the U.S. Surface Transportation Board, the STB, fit in?
That's a crucial point. Yeah, the STB is indeed the paramount regulatory gatekeeper here, and their power is, well, it's immense. They hold exclusive jurisdiction over virtually every strategic move that shapes the rail landscape.
Like what specifically?
Everything from approving or rejecting mergers and any new line construction to resolving rate disputes between shippers and the railroads.
So they're really pulling the strings.
You could say that. Think of them as the ultimate chessboard masters, actively influencing who can play, what moves are allowed, and ultimately how the entire game is played out across the country. Their decisions directly impact the competitive landscape for, well, decades to come.
And they haven't been quiet lately, have they? I remember reading something about a recent STB decision involving CPKC.
You're right. They've been incredibly active. For example, just in July 2025, we saw them enforce a condition from a merger way back in 1988.
1988. Seriously.
Yeah. Making sure CPKC maintained competitive access for grain traffic moving down to the Gulf Coast.
What does that tell you? That they're really watching closely?
It clearly signals their unwavering commitment to preserving competition, even when it means reaching back decades into old merger conditions. Yeah. It shows they're not afraid to intervene and use their power to ensure shippers aren't disadvantaged by consolidation.
Mm.
But the truly game-changing development, the one that really shook things up, came concurrently in that same month, July 2025. The STB formally accepted a notice of intent for a proposed merger between Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern.
Wait, UP and NS, the two biggest U.S. players potentially merging.
Yeah, it's the proposal. This isn't just some technicality. It's potentially a seismic event for the entire industry. The final wave of consolidation, maybe.
Wow. Okay, so if UP and NS actually combine, what does that potential mega merger mean for CPKC? Is it a good news, bad news, both?
It presents a really fascinating kind of dual scenario for CPKC. It's like a strategic tightrope walk for them.
How so?
Well, on one hand, a combined UP and NS would create a truly immense competitor, a railroad leviathan, really, with unparalleled scale and network reach across both the eastern and western U.S.
Which could squeeze CPKC.
Over the very long term, potentially, yes. It could marginalize the relatively smaller CPKC, making it harder to compete for certain types of freight moving purely within the U.S.
Okay, that's the threat. What's the flip side?
The flip side, and this is where the opportunity lies, is the regulatory process itself. The review for a merger of that magnitude would likely be exceptionally complex, probably very contentious,
yeah,
and could easily span several years.
Right. The STB would scrutinize every detail.
Absolutely. It would undoubtedly consume vast amounts of management attention, capital, legal resources. Basically, it would be a huge distraction for both Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern.
Ah, so while they're tied up with the merger review.
Exactly. This period of intense regulatory distraction for two of its largest rivals could provide CPKC with a crucial, perhaps even a singular, window of opportunity.
A chance to solidify their own position?
Precisely. It's a chance for them to focus solely and relentlessly on fully integrating KCS, nailing down its new, unique north-south service offerings, and aggressively capturing market share while their biggest competitors are preoccupied navigating that labyrinthine regulatory process. It's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? Their rivals' ambitions might just create CPKC's biggest opening.
That is fascinating. So how do these big strategic plays translate into what's actually moving on the rails day to day? You mentioned rail traffic is like an economic barometer.
Yeah, it really is. In many ways, rail traffic serves as a real-time economic barometer for the North American industrial economy. And if you look at the trends from 2024 and into early 2025, we're seeing what you could aptly call a bifurcated market.
Bifurcated, meaning split.
Yeah, essentially two distinct segments of the economy behaving quite differently. On one side, you have intermodal traffic. That's largely shipping containers and truck trailers carrying consumer goods.
Stuff people buy.
Right. That showed pretty robust growth. In the first 2 months of 2025, total intermodal volume rose a healthy 8.5% compared to the previous year.
Okay, so consumers were still spending.
It seems so. This was primarily driven by strong consumer spending and a noticeable rebound in import volumes coming through key West Coast ports. It paints a picture of resilient consumers still actively buying and goods flowing into the country to meet that demand.
All right, that's one side. What's the other?
The other side is carload traffic.
Yeah.
That's the non-intermodal freight. Things like raw materials, industrial components, bulk commodities like chemicals, lumber.
The building blocks of industry.
Yeah, exactly. That segment actually fell 2.0% over the same period. This persistent weakness reflects an ongoing, really a two-year slump in the U.S. manufacturing sector. It's been struggling with weak demand, inventory adjustments, competitive pressures.
So consumers, okay, industry not so much. A two-speed economy.
That's a good way to put it. Reflected right there in the rail volumes.
And there's another big cloud hanging over the industry, right? Coal.
Oh, absolutely. That's a significant secular headwind that the entire rail industry has been navigating for years.
Mm.
The steady, undeniable decline of coal.
It used to be huge for them, didn't it?
Foundational. And highly profitable, particularly in the U.S. Yet in 2024, U.S. coal shipments fell by a striking 13.6% to a record low.
Wow. 13.6% drop in 1 year.
Yeah. And even at that record low, it still accounted for over a quarter of all carloads, which just shows you how dominant it once was.
So it's still significant even in decline.
It is, but the trend is clear. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, the EIA, forecasts that U.S. coal production will continue its descent. They see it dropping from about 512 million short tons in 2024 down to 467 million by 2026.
Why the decline? Power plant switching.
Primarily, yes. More coal-fired power plants are being retired in favor of cleaner natural gas and, of course, renewable energy sources. While global demand might plateau for a bit, the long-term outlook for North American coal consumption is unambiguously negative.
So what does that mean for railroads like CPKC? They can't just ignore losing a quarter of their carloads.
They absolutely cannot. It means they must innovate, they must diversify their revenue streams, and find entirely new sources of volume growth to offset the sustained loss of this historically high-density, profitable traffic. It's not just an option. It's really an imperative for their long-term viability and growth.
That's a fantastic transition, actually, because that imperative brings us directly to CPKC's truly unique strategic position, underpinned by this brand new transcontinental network you mentioned.
The game changer.
Exactly. You see, the post-merger CPKC now operates an astonishing 20,000-mile rail network. And here's the kicker. It's the first and only single-line system directly connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
First and only. That's the key differentiator.
It really is. This isn't just about having a bigger map on the wall. It's a profound qualitative leap in competitive advantage. It fundamentally reshapes what's possible in North American logistics.
How so? What does that single line really enable?
Well, what's particularly powerful is the unparalleled port access this network now provides. Imagine the logistical possibilities that open up when you have seamless connections to major ports on three distinct coasts.
Three coasts?
Yeah. The Pacific via Vancouver, the Atlantic via St. John in Canada, multiple crucial ports along the U.S. Gulf Coast, and critically, access to both Pacific and Gulf Coast in Mexico, including the really important deepwater port of Lázaro Cárdenas.
So shippers can reach almost anywhere from one network.
Pretty much. For shippers, this means fewer headaches, potentially faster transit times, and a dramatic reduction in complexity.
Makes sense.
Now, it's important to acknowledge, despite this incredible reach and strategic advantage, CPKC is still the smallest Class A railroad by revenue.
Right. They're not the biggest player overall.
No. In 2024, the combined company generated revenues of about $14.5 billion. For comparison, Union Pacific was over $24 billion. So being the biggest isn't the primary story here.
So what is the story?
Instead, the core investment thesis for CPKC is all about its strategic positioning. It is now uniquely situated to capture new, high-growth north-south trade flows that were simply inaccessible, or at least very difficult to access efficiently, for either predecessor railroad.
The Mexico connection being key there.
Absolutely. And we're already seeing hints of this potential. Early in 2025, CPKC reported revenue growth that was driven more by an increase in revenue per unit, essentially, getting better pricing or a better mix for premium services, rather than just a huge jump in overall volume.
So focusing on higher value freight first.
Exactly. It suggests a very deliberate initial focus on operational integration and establishing premium pricing for the new seamless services they're now uniquely able to offer. It's about the quality of revenue, not just the sheer quantity.
Okay, that makes sense. But even with these unique advantages, they're still competing, right? Who's the main competitor?
Well, that brings us to the elephant in the room.
Indeed. And even with these distinct advantages, the primary competitive threat to the rail industry, and specifically to CPKC's ambitious growth strategy, remains the trucking industry.
Trucks, right. They move most of the stuff.
They really do. When you look at the total value of merchandise trade flowing across North America, trucks are the undisputed dominant mode. In 2024, trucks carried a staggering 64.4% of the value of trade between the U.S. and its NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico.
64%. And what was rail's share?
Rail's share, in stark contrast, was a mere 12.7%.
Wow, that's a colossal gap. Huge challenge for CPKC, then, trying to convert that truck freight.
It absolutely is, and it raises a vital question.
Yeah.
Why isn't rail more competitive, given its fundamental advantages?
Yeah, you hear about how efficient trains are.
Because rail does have clear, undeniable strengths, especially over long distances. It's remarkably superior in terms of fuel and labor efficiency. Think about this again. A single freight train can move 1 ton of goods about 470 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel.
Nearly 500 miles on a gallon? That's incredible.
It is. That makes it nearly 4 times more fuel efficient than a truck. And imagine a convoy of hundreds of trucks taken off the highway and replaced by a single train. That leads to significant labor cost savings for the railroad.
Fewer drivers needed.
Exactly. And clear environmental benefits for everyone. This cost advantage becomes even more pronounced as the length of the haul increases. And critically, it's strongest during periods of high diesel fuel prices.
Ah, so when gas prices are high, rail looks better.
Precisely. In fact, a study back in 2008 found a statistically significant positive correlation between diesel prices and rail's market share. As fuel costs rise for trucks, some freight naturally shifts from highway to rail as shippers look for more economical options.
So CPKC's strategy must be built around exploiting that, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Their strategy is explicitly designed to exploit this differential. By creating these new single-line routes, for example, from the U.S. Midwest directly down to industrial centers in Mexico, they are directly targeting long-haul freight that currently moves almost exclusively via truck.
Makes sense. But is cost enough?
That's the million-dollar question. The success of this modal conversion strategy moving freight from highway to rail, it hinges on two crucial factors for CPKC. First, they must consistently maintain a significant and demonstrable cost advantage over trucking.
It could be cheaper.
Right. And second, and perhaps even more critically for shippers, especially those with valuable or time-sensitive goods, they must provide a level of service reliability and speed that is truly competitive with truck transit times.
So it can't just be cheap. It has to be dependable and reasonably fast.
Exactly. It's not enough to simply be cheaper if your service is slow or unpredictable. That's the real battleground where they need to win freight from trucks.
You've hit on a critical point there about speed and reliability. And I think to truly appreciate the breakthrough CPKC is aiming for, we need to paint a picture of how complex things used to be.
Right. The pre-merger world.
Yeah. Imagine you're a manufacturer. You've got a factory in Monterrey, Mexico, and you need to get a container full of valuable goods all the way up to a distribution center in, say, Calgary, Canada. Before CPKC, this journey was what shippers often called a logistical, well, a nightmare, a Gordian knot of multiple interchanges.
Interchanges meaning handoffs between different railroads.
Exactly. The container might start on the Kansas City Southern Network in Mexico. It travels north to a major border point like Laredo, Texas, and there it hits its first big headache. It has to be physically lifted off one train, usually by a huge crane.
It takes time, costs money.
Right. And then placed onto a train operated by a different U.S. railroad, maybe UP or BNSF. That whole process could take hours, sometimes even a day or more, just to get slotted into the new railroad schedule.
Ugh. And that's just the first handoff.
Exactly. If its final destination was Canada, it would likely undergo a second such interchange, probably in a notoriously congested hub like Chicago. Lifted again, transferred onto either CN or the old Canadian Pacific network.
So multiple lifts, multiple delays, multiple points of failure.
Precisely. Each of these interchanges, each physical lift, each transfer, each bureaucratic handoff added significant time, cost, and layers of complexity. It meant more terminal dwell time cars just sitting around, more admin friction, and crucially, more points where things could go wrong, causing delays.
Which kills Rails' advantage for anything time-sensitive.
Totally. This cumulative inefficiency just chipped away at Rails' inherent cost advantage, making it uncompetitive for all but the least time-sensitive, often bulk, freight. That's why long-haul trucking dominated so much of the market for higher-value goods. But here's the real game changer.
The CPKC single-line solution.
Yes. CPKC's single-line service eliminates these friction points entirely.
How does that work in practice?
Now, that same container from Monterey can be loaded onto a CPKC train and traveled directly to Chicago or Toronto or Calgary without ever being physically handled again by another railroad. It's one seamless journey on one continuous network.
That sounds revolutionary, actually, for logistics.
It really is. This streamlined, seamless approach directly attacks the primary advantages trucking had: speed and simplicity. Their flagship service, the Mexico Midwest Express, or MMX, is the prime example of this in action. They're running dedicated intermodal trains that just cut through all that historical complexity.
So MMX is their showpiece.
It really is. And this isn't just about trying to steal existing rail traffic from other carriers, though I'm sure they'd like to. It's about fundamentally expanding the total addressable market for rail freight.
Going after the trucks.
Exactly. It's about capturing a significant portion of the literally tens of thousands of truckloads that cross the U.S.-Mexico border daily, freight that moved by road simply because traditional multi-line rail service was too slow, too costly, or just too unreliable.
So that modal conversion is the core of the growth story.
It is the foundational pillar of the merger's massive revenue synergy potential and its long-term growth story. It's potentially transformative for North American trade flows.
Okay, so to actually deliver on that promise of seamless, reliable service, they need more than just connected tracks, right? They need an operating plan.
Absolutely. And that brings us to PSR.
Right. To achieve that kind of operational transformation, CPKC relies heavily on a disciplined operating model known as Precision Scheduled Railroading, or PSR.
PSR. We hear that term a lot with railroads now. What exactly is it?
Well, it's not just some trendy buzzword. It's a profound fundamental shift in how a railroad operates. It was pioneered by the late legendary railroad executive Hunter Harrison. And PSR fundamentally moves away from the traditional hub-and-spoke model.
What was that model like?
In the old model, the focus was often on building really long trains and basically waiting for them to fill up before dispatching them. You know, trains sitting idle for hours, sometimes days, just to maximize the cargo per train.
Sounds inefficient.
It often was, in terms of network flow. PSR, instead, prioritizes the continuous, disciplined movement of individual rail cars on a fixed, predetermined schedule. Think of it more like a passenger railway.
Trains run on time, predictable schedules.
Exactly. The idea is that a train leaves on time, whether it's perfectly full or not, to keep the entire network flowing efficiently. This predictability and continuous flow are absolutely key to the whole philosophy.
And CPKC's leadership is fully bought in.
Oh, completely. CPKC's management team, led by CEO Keith Creel, is deeply committed to this PSR philosophy. And for good reason, Creel was a key lieutenant to Hunter Harrison himself and helped implement it very successfully at Canadian Pacific before the merger.
So he knows it inside out.
He does. They articulate their approach through five core foundations, each designed to drive efficiency across the entire network. First, relentlessly improving customer service, making the trains run on time for the shippers. Second, meticulously controlling costs. Third, optimizing asset utilization.
Getting the most out of every locomotive and car.
Precisely. Making sure every asset is working as hard as possible. Fourth, operating safely, which is absolutely paramount in railroading. And fifth, developing their employees to ensure the entire team is aligned and executing the plan. Each of these pillars works together to drive efficiency and predictability.
And we know PSR worked well at the old CP, right? There were some dramatic results.
Absolutely. Mm. The impact of PSR on the legacy Canadian Pacific network was nothing short of dramatic. There was a white paper back in 2016 that detailed the truly quantifiable improvements achieved in the years following PSR's implementation, starting around 2012.
What kind of improvements are we talking?
These weren't just incremental tweaks. You're talking really impressive double-digit improvements across the board. From 2011 to 2015, their network speed, a critical measure of efficiency, improved by 40%.
40% faster, wow.
Yeah. Train length increased by 19%, allowing them to move more freight with fewer, longer trains. That's the time a rail car spends just sitting idle in a terminal waiting to move, was reduced by a significant 19%.
Getting rid of bottlenecks.
Exactly. And perhaps most strikingly, locomotive productivity soared by 40%. This enabled CP to move the same amount of freight with a remarkable 700 fewer locomotives.
700 fewer engines. That must have saved a fortune.
Think about it. 700 fewer massive, expensive pieces of equipment. That represents hundreds of millions in capital freed up or avoided. Just huge efficiency gains.
And did this translate to the bottom line? Is there a metric for that?
Absolutely. These operational improvements didn't just look good on paper. They translated directly into superior financial performance. When we talk about efficiency in railroads, the key metric everyone watches is the operating ratio, or OR.
Okay, OR. What is that exactly?
Think of it like a business's expense report. It simply measures operating expenses as a percentage of revenue. And for a railroad, lower is always better. It signifies a leaner, more profitable operation.
So lower OR means more efficient. How did CP do?
CP's adjusted OR fell dramatically. It went from 81% in 2011, which was pretty average, down to an industry-leading 61% by 2015.
From 81 to 61, that's a massive improvement.
It was incredible. And this incredible efficiency created this powerful virtuous cycle. Mm. Improved asset utilization led to significantly lower operating costs and higher profit margins, which in turn generated strong free cash flow.
And they could reinvest that cash.
Right. That cash flow could then be reinvested back into the business for further growth or returned to shareholders. So the central exciting challenge now for CPKC is replicating this very same success, taking that proven PSR playbook and applying it with the same rigor and discipline to the newly acquired and frankly significantly different KCS network.
That sounds like the plan. But integrating two huge railroads, that can't be easy, right? Were there bumps initially?
You're right. It's crucial to understand that while the promise of PSR is incredibly compelling, integrating two massive rail networks is an incredibly complex undertaking. And yes, the initial operational metrics did indeed reflect these challenges.
What did the numbers show?
Well, in the first quarter of 2025, if you look at the comparative analysis, CPKC's key service metrics, specifically average terminal dwell time and average train speed, had actually deteriorated compared to the prior year.
So things got worse initially?
Temporarily, yes. And this was in stark contrast to peers like Norfolk Southern and BNSF, both of which actually registered service improvements during that same period.
Ouch. Did management explain why?
They did. They were pretty transparent about it, attributing the temporary decline to the inherent complexities of combining disparate operating systems, harmonizing different processes, aligning cultures,
right,
particularly in the southern U.S. portion of the network, the old KCS territory.
So basically, merging is hard.
It truly shows you that even with a proven playbook and strong leadership, merging two giant systems isn't like flipping a switch. It's a massive, intricate puzzle.
But did they turn it around? Did PSR start to bite on the KCS lines?
That's the real story here, the speed of the turnaround. By the second quarter of 2025, CPKC reported significant, almost rapid progress in applying the PSR model to these new assets.
What specific improvements did they highlight?
Management specifically highlighted a dramatic turnaround on the legacy KCS network in the U.S. during the final 2 months of that quarter. They reported that terminal dwell time, that critical measure of idle time, improved by a remarkable 42%.
42% improvement in dwell, that's huge.
It is. And car miles per car day, a key measure of how efficiently assets are actually moving, improved by 38%.
So cars were moving much faster through the system.
Exactly. Furthermore, the company's consolidated core adjusted operating ratio for Q2 2025, that crucial efficiency metric we talked about, improved by 110 basis points year over year to a strong 60.7%.
So the overall efficiency improved too.
Yes. This rapid improvement suggests that while the integration process certainly faced initial hurdles, the PSR model is being successfully deployed and is indeed starting to yield the expected powerful efficiency gains on the acquired assets.
So for you, the listener, what should people be watching?
For you, monitoring these key performance indicators like train speed and terminal dwell will be critical leading indicators of the merger's ongoing operational success. For instance, in Q2 2025, CPKC's average train speed was 18.8 miles per hour, and their average terminal dwell was down to 9.8 hours.
How does that compare?
Well, if you compare that to Union Pacific, for example, UP had a faster average train speed at 24.1 miles per hour, but their average terminal dwell was much longer at 22.5 hours.
Ah, so CPKC is really focusing on keeping things moving in the yards.
Exactly. It gives you a clear sense of CPKC's focus on keeping those cars moving efficiently through terminals, which is really a hallmark of PSR, minimizing that costly idle time.
Okay, these deep operational insights really bring us to the heart of the matter, don't they? The KCS combination as this truly generational growth catalyst.
The core rationale.
Yeah. The financial rationale for this massive merger is underpinned by a very bold target. Achieving approximately $1 billion in annualized EBITDA synergies within 3 years of gaining operational control, which started back in April 2023. This is the billion-dollar question that fuels the entire investment thesis.
$1 billion in synergies, that's a big number.
It's huge. And this billion-dollar target isn't just a lump sum. It has a crucial breakdown that really reveals CPKC's strategic intent. An investor presentation from back in November 2021 detailed it explicitly.
Okay, how does it break down?
Get this, a vast $820 million is expected to come from revenue and market synergies.
80% from revenue, not cost-cutting.
Exactly. That's the vast majority. It's derived from new market opportunities unlocked by that single-line network, expanded single-line haul routes, and critically, attracting freight from trucks onto this newly integrated, more efficient network. It's about creating new business, not just trimming fat.
So cost-cutting is secondary?
Relatively speaking, yes. The remaining $180 million is projected from cost and efficiency synergies. That comes from things like improved fuel efficiency from PSR, reduced equipment rents, consolidation of some facilities and IT systems, important stuff, but clearly not the primary driver here. The growth is the story.
Okay, so that was the plan. How are they doing on delivering that billion?
Well, the good news is execution against these ambitious targets appears to be progressing remarkably well. During their Q4 2024 earnings call, management stated they were actually ahead of synergy capture targets.
Ahead of schedule. That's impressive.
It is. They reported closing 2024 with a synergy run rate already in excess of $800 million, and they projected adding another $300 million in 2025.
So that would be over $1.1 billion total, exceeding the target.
Exactly. It would put them on track to actually exceed the original $1 billion target and ahead of schedule. Now, what's really important to understand here is why those revenue synergies matter so much more than just cost savings.
Why is that distinction so critical?
Because unlike one-time cost reductions, which are great for the bottom line, but often have a finite limit, right? You can only cut so much. Revenue synergies represent sustainable, profitable growth that leverages the unique strategic value of the combined network.
So it's about expanding the pie, not just taking a bigger slice of the old one.
Perfectly put. They are inherently more valuable for long-term investors because they represent real growth. And we're talking about key initiatives driving this, like that flagship Mexico Midwest Express service we mentioned.
The MMX.
Right. Also the Gemini Alliance partnership, a brand new refrigerated container fleet specifically for intermodal going after produce and proteins.
I value stuff.
Definitely. New closed loop services for automotive manufacturers, which even earned them a prestigious GM Supplier of the Year award, by the way.
Shows the service quality is there.
It does. And also new single line routes for bulk commodities like grain, plastics, and refined products. It's all about creatively leveraging that unparalleled new connectivity to generate new profitable business.
And that new connectivity seems perfectly timed for another big trend, doesn't it? Nearshoring.
Absolutely. That new connectivity is perfectly aligned with one of the most powerful secular growth opportunities unfolding across North America right now, the trend of nearshoring.
Can you unpack nearshoring for us? What exactly is it?
Sure. Essentially, this is where North American companies are strategically relocating their manufacturing and sourcing operations from distant places like Asia back to Mexico.
Bringing production closer to home. Why now?
Well, it's not just a fleeting trend. It's driven by a compelling desire to shorten increasingly complex and, frankly, fragile global supply chains we saw disrupted recently, also to reduce geopolitical risks associated with far-flung manufacturing, and importantly, to leverage the significant benefits of the USMCA trade agreement, the new NAFTA, which provides a framework for integrated North American supply chains.
So CPKC is just riding this wave.
Well, what's truly compelling is that CPKC isn't merely a passive beneficiary of this trend. They're actively enabling it. They're becoming a core part of the solution for companies looking to nearshore.
How are they enabling it? Investing in infrastructure?
Exactly. The company is making significant capital investments to facilitate the expected surge in cross-border traffic that this shift will bring. The most critical of these is the completion, back in December 2024, of a second span for the International Railway Bridge at the Laredo-Texas Gateway.
Laredo, that's the big one, right? Busiest rail crossing.
It is. North America's busiest rail border crossing. And this project is a massive deal because this new span more than doubles the capacity there. It's a direct, strategic investment in unlocking the full potential of a combined network to handle these potentially unprecedented volumes flowing north and south.
So building the capacity for the nearshoring boom.
Precisely. And they're also aggressively launching new services to capture this freight. The Mexico Midwest Express, MMX, intermodal service we keep mentioning is a prime example. This now offers the first single-line rail option for refrigerated shippers.
The reefer containers?
Right. Moving temperature-sensitive goods like fresh produce, proteins, directly between the U.S., Midwest, and Mexico. This is a market that historically has been almost entirely dominated by trucks, simply because you need that seamless, temperature-controlled transit.
And CPKC is investing in those special containers.
They are. To support this, CPKC has actually more than doubled its fleet of 53-foot refrigerated intermodal containers and connecting the dots even further.
There's more.
Yeah, in partnership with a cold storage provider called Americold, CPKC is building a new import-export hub right at its Kansas City intermodal facility. That's slated to open in mid-2025.
So integrating cold storage right at the rail hub.
Exactly. This entire ecosystem creates what you might call a self-reinforcing growth loop. Better logistics make nearshoring to Mexico more attractive for businesses, which in turn drives more rail traffic for CPKC, which justifies more investment. You see the cycle.
Yeah, it feeds itself. It's truly a strategic play on a massive macroeconomic shift that's reshaping global supply chains.
It really is. And this strategic shift, combined with the nearshoring trend, has fundamentally improved the revenue quality and diversification of CPKC's business. It makes it much more robust.
How so? What was wrong with the old CP's revenue mix?
Well, before this merger, Canadian Pacific, as a standalone entity, was pretty heavily exposed to the cyclicality of Canadian bulk commodities, especially things like grain and potash.
Which depend on harvests and global prices.
Yeah.
Very volatile.
Exactly. Inherently subject to harvest cycles, volatile global commodity prices, so their revenue could be quite unpredictable year to year.
And KCS brings something different to the table.
Totally different. The KCS network, with its distinct north-south orientation, brings a highly complementary book of business. This means significant exposure to those high-growth, cross-border intermodal flows we just highlighted.
The stuff moving between the U.S. and Mexico.
Right. Also, the crucial automotive supply chain, with its intricate, just-in-time demands, and things like refined petroleum products moving across the border. This integration creates a much more balanced and resilient mix of revenue streams for the combined company.
So less reliance on just one or two commodities.
Precisely. And you can see this diversification clearly in the combined company's revenue profile. If you look at the first quarter of 2025, no single commodity group accounted for more than 21% of their total freight revenue.
That's pretty balanced.
It is. It tells you they aren't overly reliant on any one sector. The business is now nicely balanced across three main segments. Bulk, which represents about 35%, merchandise at 47%, and intermodal growing at 18%.
And even within those segments?
Even within those, specific commodities like grain are around 21%, energy, chemicals, and plastics around 20%. This wide diversification significantly reduces the company's reliance on any single sector of the economy, making its earnings stream much more resilient and less volatile over the course of a business cycle.
Makes sense. Smoother earnings.
Right. And the increased exposure to structurally growing end markets like cross-border, intermodal, and automotive provides a powerful long-term tailwind. Critically, this helps to offset that secular decline in coal volumes we talked about earlier. It's really a portfolio built for more stability and growth going forward.
Okay, so the strategy looks sound. The operations are improving. The revenue mix is better. Let's talk about the financial performance itself.
Yeah.
How do we measure if this massive acquisition is actually creating value?
Great question. And that really brings us to a key metric, ROIC.
Right. Now, when we look at the financial performance and capital allocation, we absolutely need to talk about return on invested capital. Or ROIC.
Explain ROIC for us. Why is it so important?
Well, it's arguably the single most telling metric of long-term value creation. Basically, it measures how efficiently a company generates profits from the total capital that's been invested in it, that includes both its debt and its equity holders' money.
So how much bang are they getting for their buck?
Essentially, yes.
And
prior to the KCS transaction, Canadian Pacific was a truly high ROIC business. They demonstrated exemplary capital discipline. Their ROIC actually peaked at an impressive 17.2% back in 2020.
17% ROIC, that's really strong.
It indicates they were a fantastic allocator of capital, highly efficient.
But the merger must have changed that picture drastically.
Oh, absolutely. This is where the acquisition creates what we call an ROIC J-curve.
A J-curve, like it dips down before going back up.
Exactly. You see a precipitous, almost immediate drop in ROIC right after the merger. It fell to 8.3% in 2021, hit a five-year low of 5.2% in 2022, and was standing at about 6.6% for the latest 12 months reported.
From 17 down to 5 or 6%, that looks bad on the surface.
It does, but it's not necessarily a red flag in itself. It's a direct mathematical consequence of the approximately $31 billion acquisition price tag.
Ah, the denominator got huge.
Precisely. That massive acquisition price dramatically increased the invested capital denominator in the ROIC calculation. ROIC equaled NOPAT invested capital. Meanwhile, the numerator, net operating profit after tax, or NOPAT, only increased initially by the amount of KCS's pre-existing earnings.
So you added a ton of capital, but only a bit more profit right away.
Exactly. Think of it like this. If you buy a huge, expensive new factory, your immediate return on all your capital will drop until that new factory starts generating significantly more profit than it did before you bought it.
Okay, that makes sense. So the key isn't the initial drop, but what happens next?
That is the absolute crucial point. The central challenge for management and the most critical metric for you, the informed listener, to monitor over the next 3 to 5 years is the trajectory of this J-curve. Where does it go from here?
Success means it goes back up steeply.
Success means that NOPAT, the profit, grows at a much faster rate, driven by those high margin revenue synergies we discussed. That growth needs to be strong enough to pull the overall ROIC back up, recovering to and ideally even exceeding its pre-merger levels.
That would prove the merger was worth the price.
Definitely. That would definitively prove the acquisition created substantial long-term shareholder value. On the flip side, a failure to achieve a steep, sustained recovery in ROIC over this investment horizon. Well, that would signal that the price paid for KCS was simply too high, or that the promised synergies failed to materialize as planned. It would indicate a potential misallocation of capital.
So watch that ROIC trend like a hawk.
Absolutely. When you look at their 10-year financial summary data, you can clearly see that dramatic drop in ROIC post-2020, illustrating this J-curve in action. Now, the critical phase of recovery is underway.
Okay, and you mentioned the acquisition costs. They took on a lot of debt for this, didn't they? How's the balance sheet looking?
Good point. To fund the cash portion of this substantial KCS acquisition, CPKC did take on a significant amount of debt, roughly $20 billion around the time of the transaction.
$20 billion in new debt, is that manageable?
As of the second quarter of 2025, their key leverage ratio, net debt to EBITDA, stood at 3.0x. Now, while that's elevated compared to where CP was historically, it's generally considered manageable for a company of this scale, especially one with strong, stable cash flows like a railroad.
So manageable, but they probably want to pay it down.
Exactly. And management has articulated a very clear and balanced capital allocation strategy, which is pretty typical of a mature, well-run industrial company like this. They have three main priorities.
What are they?
First priority is always reinvesting in the business itself. Got to keep the network safe, maintain everything, and crucially support that growth we've been talking about. They've guided capital expenditures of about $2.9 billion for 2025.
That's a lot of investment.
It is. And their long-term plan is around $2.6 to $2.8 billion per year through 2028. Importantly, a meaningful portion of this is specifically growth CapEx money directly tied to realizing those merger synergies.
Like building longer sidings, fixing up yards.
Exactly. Extending sidings so they can run longer, more efficient trains, upgrading rail yards for faster throughput, and of course that crucial Laredo Bridge expansion we highlighted earlier. Investing to enable the growth.
Okay, so reinvestment first. What's next?
After investing in the business, their next priority is deleveraging, paying down that debt. To that end, they temporarily suspended their share repurchase program right after the merger was announced to focus squarely on paying down debt and strengthening their financial position.
Makes sense. Focus on debt reduction.
Right. However, signaling increasing confidence in their future cash flow generation and the success of the integration so far, they actually announced a new share repurchase program in February 2025.
Ah, so they feel comfortable buying back shares again.
Seems so. And they even increased their dividend by a healthy 20% in April 2025.
So reinvest, pay down debt, and return cash to shareholders. Sounds balanced.
It is. This balanced approach, reinvesting for growth, deleveraging responsibly, and returning capital to shareholders, it reflects a well-managed company focused on long-term value creation. It's a testament to their financial discipline, even after a huge acquisition.
Okay, the picture sounds pretty positive overall, but no investment is without risk. What are the main headwinds or dangers facing CPKC?
That's absolutely right. While the long-term strategic rationale for CPKC is indeed compelling, it's crucial to acknowledge the significant headwinds and risks that the company faces. You can broadly categorize them into, say, macroeconomic and cyclical risks, and then operational and integration risks.
Let's start with the macro ones, the economy.
Right. First, on the macroeconomic front, you have to remember, as a freight transportation provider, CPKC's volumes and financial performance are inextricably linked to the health of the broader North American economy.
If the economy slows, people ship less stuff.
Exactly. An economic slowdown or recession would inevitably lead to reduced manufacturing output, lower consumer spending, decreased construction activity, all of which would depress freight demand across nearly all the company's commodity segments. They're definitely not immune to the economic cycle.
Has management acknowledged this risk recently?
They have. In fact, they explicitly acknowledged this risk back in April 2025 when they amended their full-year earnings guidance. They cited ongoing tariff and trade policy uncertainty and a heightened risk of economic recession as reasons for adopting a more cautious outlook.
So they see the clouds potentially gathering.
It signals a very real concern about the broader economic climate. Furthermore, that competitive dynamic with trucking, which is so central to CPKC's growth strategy, is also subject to cyclical forces, particularly fuel prices.
Right, you said rail's advantage shrinks when diesel is cheap.
Precisely. Rail's cost advantage over truck is most pronounced when diesel prices are high. A significant and sustained decline in fuel costs could narrow this advantage, potentially leading some shippers, especially those with time-sensitive intermodal fight, to shift volumes back to the highway if the cost differential diminishes.
So even with the merger strengths, they're still exposed to the economy and fuel prices.
Absolutely. Well, the KCS merger provides powerful secular tailwinds like nearshoring. You must remain cognizant of the cyclical headwinds that can impact the entire industry's performance in any given year.
Okay, what about the operational risks, things going wrong on the network itself?
You're absolutely right. And looking at some very real-world challenges from just the past few years, 2022 to 2024, the operational and integration risks really come into sharp focus.
Like what? Labor issues?
That's a big one. For instance, in Canada, CPKC has had a notably contentious relationship with the Teamsters Canada Rail Conference, the TCRC, which is its primary union there. Labor disputes led to frustrating work stoppages that severely disrupted the Canadian supply chain in both 2022 and again in 2024.
I remember that. Didn't the government have to step in?
They did. The 2024 dispute in particular was quite impactful. It involved a four-day shutdown of the national rail system and ultimately required federal government intervention to impose a binding arbitration four-year contract. This history of labor friction represents an ongoing tangible risk to network stability and fluidity, which directly impacts service to customers.
Not good for reliability. What else operationally?
Beyond labor, extreme weather events pose another constant and, frankly, growing threat to network operations. They just seem to be becoming more frequent and severe.
Like floods or fires.
Exactly. We saw this vividly with the unprecedented atmospheric river event that caused catastrophic flooding and landslides in British Columbia in late 2021 that completely severed all rail access to the crucial port of Vancouver for an extended period, severely impacting both CP and CN's ability to move goods.
A total shutdown. Wow.
Yeah. And more recently, widespread wildfires in Western Canada during the summers of 2023 and 2024 have also threatened network fluidity, forcing reroutes, delays, and posing significant operational challenges for crews on the ground. These aren't just one-off events anymore. They're becoming a structural reality that railroads must increasingly contend with.
So labor, weather, and the integration itself, still a risk.
Absolutely. The sheer complexity of integrating the KCS network cannot be overstated. Merging two Class I railroads means not just connecting tracks, right? It means combining disparate information technology systems, harmonizing vastly different operating practices that have evolved over decades, aligning numerous different union agreements, and perhaps most subtly blending distinct corporate cultures.
That sounds incredibly difficult.
It is. Management themselves acknowledged these difficulties in their Q2 2025 earnings release, citing challenges in portions of our southern U.S. network following our complex system integration. As we discussed, these challenges were reflected in that temporary dip in service metrics right after the merger closed.
So even though they're turning it around, the risk isn't zero.
Exactly. While management has a strong, proven track record of operational execution with PSR, the combination of potential labor instability, increasing climate-related disruptions, and the monumental, intricate task of the KCS integration itself creates significant operational hurdles. These could indeed impact service quality, cost control, and ultimately financial results if not expertly managed.
Okay, lots of potential, lots of risk. How is the market viewing all this? What does the valuation tell us?
That's a great question to bring it all together. So if we look at the valuation context, it's crystal clear the market is currently assigning CPKC a premium valuation compared to its peers.
A premium, meaning it's more expensive.
Relatively speaking, yes. And what's particularly insightful here is that this tells us quite a bit about the market's expectations for their future. For example, if you look at CPKC's forward price to earnings, or PE, ratio, it's generally trading in the 23x to 26x range.
How does that compare to the others?
Well, it's noticeably higher than peers like Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, which typically trade around 19 times forward earnings, or CSX, which is closer to 21 times. And if you look at historical data, a peer like CSX has traded at an average PE of around 18x over the last decade. So that 23-26x range for CPKC really highlights the current premium and the market's high hopes.
Is it just PE, or do other metrics show the same thing?
Other metrics tell a similar story, reinforcing this premium. Enterprise value to EBITDA, or EBITDA, multiples are also elevated. CPKC's current EBITDA is hovering in the 16x to 17x range. That's significantly higher than its own historical median of around 12.9x over the past decade.
Okay, so definitely a premium valuation. What does that imply for us, the listener?
What this premium unequivocally implies for you is that the market has already priced in a significant amount of future success. It's a clear vote of confidence, you could say, in the merger's strategic rationale and in management's ability to execute on their ambitious plans to capture those synergies and growth opportunities we've discussed.
But does that high price tag also mean higher risk?
Well, it certainly implies a thinner margin for error. For investors, it means any significant stumbles in the integration process or any failure to meet those robust growth expectations that are baked into the price could put this premium valuation at risk. The market is expecting near flawless execution and substantial long-term value creation.
So high expectations, high potential reward, but also higher risk if they don't deliver.
That's a good summary. When you look at a comparison table of these metrics across the Class I railroads, it really highlights how CPKC stands out with its higher valuation, signaling those elevated market expectations and the high bar they must now clear.
Okay, so going beyond just the market multiples, let's simplify. What are the fundamental drivers of CPKC's intrinsic value? What really creates wealth here over the long term?
Great question. Let's boil it down. First, you have to understand that railroads operate with incredibly high operating leverage.
Operating leverage, meaning small changes in revenue have a big impact on profit.
Exactly. Because of their massive fixed asset base, all that track, bridges, terminals, once those substantial fixed costs are covered, a very large portion of each additional dollar of revenue flows directly to profit, especially those high margin dollars coming from the merger synergies we talked about.
Like the theater analogy, once rent is paid, extra tickets are mostly profit.
Perfect analogy. This is why those revenue synergies are so incredibly powerful. Their high margin revenue being layered on top of an already established efficient cost structure. That should drive significant profit growth if they materialize.
Okay, operating leverage is one. What else?
Second, remember we talked about the oligopoly structure. As a member of this rational oligopoly with those colossal barriers to entry, the rail industry has historically demonstrated a durable ability to increase prices at a rate that actually exceeds inflation.
They have pricing power.
Yes, long-term pricing power. This is a key driver of sustained value creation and helps protect profit margins, especially during inflationary periods. It's a rare industry where a few key players can consistently command pricing like that.
Makes sense. Leverage and pricing power. Anything else?
And finally, a significant portion of CPKC's intrinsic value lies in what's called its terminal value.
Terminal value. What's that?
It's essentially the present value of all the cash flows the company is expected to generate beyond the explicit forecast period, maybe 5 or 10 years out. It represents the value of the company as an enduring entity, lasting potentially indefinitely.
So the value based on it being around for a very long time.
Precisely. And this relies on the fundamental characteristics of the business. The indefinite lifespan of this critical infrastructure franchise, the enduring barriers to entry that prevent new competition, and crucially, the company's ability to consistently earn returns on its invested capital, that ROIC metric, again, that exceed its cost of capital over the very, very long term.
Which brings us right back to ROIC.
It all comes back to that.
Yeah.
The ultimate success of the KCS integration in driving a sustained high ROIC business model is, without a doubt, the single most important determinant of CBKC's long-term intrinsic value. It's the ultimate report card on this colossal bet they've made.
Okay. So as we wrap up this deep dive, the core essence of CBKC's story seems pretty clear, doesn't it?
I think so.
The company has truly transformed itself. It went from being a strong, very efficient, but geographically constrained Canadian railroad into a genuine transcontinental powerhouse. It now boasts this unrivaled single-line network spanning North America's crucial trade corridors. It's a truly unique asset in the industry today.
And the bullish thesis for you, the listener, is both clear and powerful. It's predicated on this this really once-in-a-generation strategic combination. It creates a unique north-south network, perfectly positioned to capitalize on those powerful secular growth trends of USMCA trade and supply chain nearshoring.
And it's backed by solid operations.
Yes. The strategic advantage is backed by a proven management team with a deep-rooted and highly successful track record of operational excellence through the relentless implementation of precision scheduled railroading. The potential to convert significant volumes of freight from truck to rail on these new, efficient single-line routes forms the basis of a multi-year growth story that is truly distinctive among its Class I peers.
But as with any ambitious transformation, the risks are real too. The bearish counterarguments are equally clear and center squarely on those considerable risks we outlined.
Execution risk being number one.
Absolutely. The primary risk, as we've explored, is execution. The integration of Kansas City Southern is the largest and most complex rail merger in decades. Any significant missteps in harmonizing operations, technology, and corporate cultures could jeopardize those promised synergies.
On the debt.
Right. To finance this ambition, the company has added substantial leverage to its balance sheet, increasing its financial risk profile. And finally, CPKC is not immune to the forces that affect the entire industry. Its performance is still subject to the cyclicality of the broader macroeconomy, the volatility of fuel prices, and that ever-present threat of operational disruptions from labor disputes and those increasingly impactful extreme weather events.
So it's not a slam dunk.
Not at all. Ultimately, the investment proposition for CPKC over the next 3 to 5 years is really a referendum on management's ability to navigate these multifaceted challenges and deliver on the merger's transformative potential. The path forward will be defined by their success in seamlessly integrating KCS, realizing that ambitious billion-dollar synergy target, and maybe most importantly, driving a strong and sustained recovery in the company's return on invested capital.
And the market's watching closely.
Very closely. The market's current premium valuation suggests it expects success, which, as we said, makes the margin for error relatively thin.
So maybe a final thought to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Consider this. In an increasingly digital world, right, where so much focus is on virtual connections and abstract data, we often overlook the foundational importance of physical infrastructure like these railroads.
The things that actually move the goods.
Exactly. So how might CPKC's success, or the broader trends it represents in re-engineering North American supply chains, subtly influence global trade dynamics, or geopolitical stability, or even the future of manufacturing innovation over the next decade?
Interesting ripple effects.
What kind of unexpected opportunities or challenges might emerge from these evolving logistical arteries that underpin so much of our daily lives? And perhaps, how might it even reshape our understanding of what constitutes true economic power in the 21st century? Something to think about.